Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran learning. issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
Your efforts have produced a strong majority of the popular vote, victories in a majority of the contests, and after tonight, a majority of pledged delegates.
Voice of Hillary Clinton essentially accepting the nomination of her party, even though the convention is a ways off with her victory in California. I don't know if you call it a victory. She split, if I'm not mistaken, she split the delegates with Bernie Sanders, so she tied there delegate-wise. But it did put her just ever so slightly over the total that she needed for to be the presumptive nominee, that is, of the Democratic Party running for the President of the United States. We're going to be talking about Tuesday's election results, potential vice president candidates for both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, and some other things pertaining to the November elections on this Wednesday afternoon, June the 8th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Welcome back. Mark Hemingway joins us. He's senior writer for the Weekly Standard. Mark, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Hey, thanks again for having me.
And Molly Hemingway is senior editor for The Federalist. Molly, welcome back to you as well.
Great to be here with you.
Molly, let's talk a little bit about what happened on Tuesday in California.
Sure. It was really important election day, particularly for Hillary Clinton, because she truly wrapped up the nomination fight. She already had enough delegates, if you combine the super delegates or the sort of important people in the party and the elected delegates that you get by winning these primaries and caucuses. But on Tuesday, with her decisive victory in California, she also had the majority of elected delegates, enough to secure the nomination for presidency. And the Associated Press kind of stole her thunder a little bit because they announced the day before that she'd actually wrapped up the nomination. And she wanted to have this very triumphant victory speech after the California win where she could talk about what a historic moment it is because she's the first female nominee from a major party. But it was still pretty historic for her. And she hoped that it would be enough to get Bernie Sanders out of the race. But unfortunately, it doesn't seem that he's quite willing to back down just yet.
I want to come back to Bernie Sanders and his disposition after all of this. But Molly, can you explain to me why it is the AP was already calling Hillary Clinton, putting her over the top for the number of delegates she needed, even before the polls closed on Tuesday?
Yeah, so there's a lot of debate about whether this is an okay practice or not, because what AP did is they called up people who are superdelegates. Again, this is kind of the elites in the party who are given a vote for the nomination process. And it just straight up asked them, who are you going to vote for? And those are not solid commitments. You know, it's just like calling anybody else up before an election and saying, who are you going to vote for? Superdelegates don't actually vote until the convention. So the fact that they say they're going to vote for Hillary is not as decisive as an actual, once the vote is actually taken. So that's all that AP did, and that is a very common practice for the Associated Press to do this with Democratic races, and they did it 4 years ago and 8 years ago. But because this is such a contentious battle, a lot of Bernie Sanders fans felt that this was a betrayal and that this was not journalistically defensible.
Mark, talk about the other races, New Jersey, North Dakota, Montana, New Mexico, South Dakota.
It was a pretty mixed night. I mean, on the whole, I mean, yes, Clinton did sort of, win the important contest in California, convincingly. But, Sanders still got 206 out of the state's 475 delegates. And elsewhere, things were either good for Sanders or pretty evenly split. He won 13 delegates to 5 for Clinton in North Dakota. He narrowly won Montana, got 11 delegates, Hillary's 10, and Clinton elsewhere, where she did win in places like New Mexico and New Jersey, her, again, it was just, a handful of delegates above Bernie. So, I mean, again, if you're Bernie Sanders and you're looking to say, you know, say that he was, you know, relevant in this election, you could point to the results last night and say that, you know, Sanders, you know, clearly still made a good showing at a time when people know that Hillary Clinton already had the race wrapped up. You know, it's not like, you know, it's decisive. Hillary is the nominee now, according to the primary process, but it's not, you know, a triumphant moment, you know, looking at the math for sure.
Mark, is he still in the race? Is Bernie Sanders still in the race?
Well, I mean, he's not by any normal conventional metric. You know, Hillary Clinton has secured the number of delegates that she needs, but, you know, he's not too, you know, far behind if you look at pledged delegates. I mean, he's only 350 pledged delegates behind Hillary Clinton, and you know, if you look at how he was, if you're still hung up on how he was treated early on, I mean, he was never taken seriously at the beginning. The Democratic Party itself did all kinds of things to throw roadblocks in the path of his campaign. You look at the momentum he gathered over the course of the campaign. You know, his supporters are still making a case that he's better suited to unite the party than Hillary Clinton. And it's already thousands of people have pledged to go to the Democratic convention in Philadelphia and disrupt it, you know, on behalf of Sanders because they think that he's the nominee. Now, I don't think this is going to, you know, stop Hillary Clinton from being the nominee, obviously. But, you know, pardon me, you know, this has been a very unconventional year with a lot of crazy things happening. There's some part of me that doesn't want to rule out something crazy happening at the Democratic convention.
Well, there's another thing, too, which is that he just has a lot of power by virtue of the fact that Hillary Clinton needs him to go away so that she can focus on Donald Trump. And the longer that he keeps her having to battle this, like, two-front process is very bad for her, and it's very good for Donald Trump. So he kind of holds some cards here that are totally separate from the actual delegate math.
What does she do, Molly? Because I agree with you. She needs him to go away in order to move forward, and he knows that, and everyone else knows that, and I'm sure Donald Trump would like Bernie Sanders to continue to run outside the race as long as he possibly can. What does she do?
Well, this is why the problems that the Democratic Party is very good at dealing with its problems, but they actually have a pretty serious problem on their hands right now. And she needs to somehow show him respect and show his followers respect and show that his issues will actually make a difference in her campaign. But of course, she doesn't want to do that because she doesn't want to open herself to a vulnerability by being, you know, a socialist, which she's really trying at this moment to be the candidate who can reach out to Republicans, who can reach out to conservatives, because they're left wandering right now. A lot of them are left wandering because of what's happening in their own party. But I want to make one point, though, which is that the way that people are trying to make this problem go away is the worst possible method, which is to shame Bernie and his supporters for not being sufficiently obsequious about her being the first female to clinch the nomination. So he gave this speech last night. He was very gracious. He was gracious. The crowd wasn't gracious. And you saw all these pundits and big Democrats saying that he wasn't sufficiently, he should have sort of bowed down to her. And I think that's exactly the wrong approach, because the Bernie and his supporters feel they've been disrespected. To say that they need to be more humble in her face is just going to perpetuate this even longer.
It's also true that, you know, Bernie Sanders have not been going quietly into this good night. I mean, there are reporters that have been reporting that they are getting, you know, really angry calls and threats from Bernie supporters for the way that they are, you know, sort of declaring the end of the race. And just, you know, like I said, I already mentioned, there are all thousands of people that are pledging to disrupt the Democratic convention on behalf of Bernie. And, you know, they really do feel like an injustice has been committed here. And, you know, I wouldn't say, as far as the, you know, political shenanigans go, it's been, you know, the most egregious thing out there, but they do have some very legitimate complaints about the way that they were treated by the DNC and the way the Democratic establishment basically, you know, gave them the stiff arm in ways that were really, really unfair at the beginning and continued to do that throughout the process. I mean, it was very clear very early on that they wanted Hillary Clinton to be the nominee, and they threw up all kinds of roadblocks in Bernie Sanders' campaign, in front of Bernie Sanders' campaign.
Molly, I played a little game this morning early. I think the Washington Post had up a pool of possible VP picks for both of the presumptive candidates, both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, a couple dozen for each one of them. And you could kind of tailor your pick by saying whether or not you wanted to be male or female from a swing state or not, or be a historic first, something along, or from the South, something like this. And it would show you who fit the bill of your particular preferences for a VP pick. And it was an interesting little exercise. This has probably got to be the biggest question both candidates are asking themselves right now, isn't it?
Oh, certainly. And I think it's particular. Both candidates have challenging situations in front of them. Hillary Clinton has a challenge in that there isn't a very good bench in Democratic politics. It's sort of odd that we're seeing such dramatic implosion of the Republican Party and not the Democratic one, given that the Democratic Party is actually kind of weak right now. So she's going to be trying to shore up support demographically, picking a Hispanic vice president, picking someone from a state that she needs to secure or whatnot. Whereas Donald Trump's issues are just, like himself, totally non-conventional, unconventional. Usually when you're picking a vice president, you want someone who is, you just need him for demographics. You need him for the state. I think that what Donald Trump should do is follow what Bill Clinton did in 1992, where he deviated from that conventional wisdom of picking someone to balance him out. He instead picked someone very much like him, which was Al Gore. They were both moderate Democrats. I forget what the name of that, the Democratic Leadership Coalition was there, a group that they were part of, entitlement reform-minded Southern guys who, they were very similar, and it worked very well for him. And I think that's what Donald Trump should try and do, is don't worry about the state that the person is from or any particular demographic issue. Pick someone who can help massage your message and help figure out how to overcome some of your weaknesses. And so someone like Newt Gingrich, I think, would be very good for Donald Trump, because he can provide a level of importance without subverting the message.
What are your thoughts, Mark?
Well, I think that, you know, like Molly says, the Democratic Party is really weak right now, but there are any number of people that, you know, would foot the bill. You know, like Molly said, you know, somebody who's maybe younger, you know, has some sort of demographic appeal, like Cory Booker from New Jersey or Julian Castro, who's the current Housing and Urban Development Secretary, you know, that just sort of plug in to the ticket, you know, just fill it out and, you know, go. And whereas I think Trump has a much, much bigger problem on his hands. Like Molly mentioned, like Newt Gingrich would be a good person to pick in the sense that he's, you know, got a storied history in Republican politics. He's a very smart guy. He'd be, you know, a good party insider that could reassure people when Trump does his, you know, whole shtick. But, you know, as we recently saw, I mean, Trump just went on a tear going after Newt, because Newt had to go out and denounce Trump's comments about the quote-unquote Mexican judge who was born in Indiana that's handling the Trump University fraud case. So, you know, Trump tends to demand complete ideological fealty, and more to the point, right now, because of the things that Trump has done and said in this campaign, anybody with a future in Republican politics is probably running away from him. Now, things can change. Maybe things will settle down a month or two from now, and Trump will be, you know, more on the straight and narrow, and people may be more willing to stick their neck out. But so far, he's down in the polls, and he doesn't seem like a terribly reliable guy, and you have to completely sign on to his agenda. So I don't think there's too many Republicans going to be lining up to do that if they haven't already.
I disagree with you on this. I don't think that Trump even has an ideology, so there's no way that he can demand fealty to it. He does require subservience from people who endorse him, and you saw that. He had all these former critics with whom he disagreed on all sorts of things, from, you know, Chris Christie to various other, you know, Rick Perry. He's totally fine with having them come on board his campaign. They don't even need to agree with I don't think he requires people to agree with him. He just needs them to be subservient. I don't know if he's going to do that for his vice presidential pick, because the stakes are so high.
I don't see much of a disagreement, though, between requiring someone to agree with you and requiring them to completely shut your mouth when you're putting your foot in it, which is the case of Trump.
Well, no, take even Renee Elmers, the first woman, the first candidate he endorsed, who lost her primary last night. They don't even agree on, I mean, I think she's like an open borders immigration dove, and he is this big immigration hawk. So he didn't even require agreement on that. I don't really think he has ideology. I think his ideology is whatever is good for him. So as long as you get on board that train, he doesn't really care what you believe.
So he needs Chris Christie to stand behind him and look pensive.
Basically, it would have to be somebody like that who's already completely signed on to the Trump train, whatever, you know, whatever Trump is going to do. He can't really have somebody who's going to be going out there and being his own man, which is kind of a shame because I think that's what he needs. He needs kind of a Newt Gingrich guy to actually balance him out, some guy who's going to have his own opinions and his own gravitas that can, you know, reassure people, whereas, you know, having somebody who's just going to stand there and be, you know, yes, sir, all the time, like Chris Christie appears to have done since he signed on with the campaign, just doesn't seem like it's the kind of thing that's going to reassure people that have doubts about Trump.
Mark Hemingway is senior writer for the Weekly Standard, along with Molly Hemingway, senior editor for The Federalist. We're getting our weekly update on the November elections on this Wednesday afternoon, June the 8th. More on that when we come back. We'll return to the issue of Judge Curiel and the Trump University case. Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. St. John Lutheran, Springfield, Pennsylvania. Zion Lutheran, Detroit, Michigan. St. Paul's Lutheran, Long Beach, California. All Saints Lutheran, Charlotte, North Carolina. Redeemer Lutheran, Colorado Springs, Colorado. Shepherd of the Lake Lutheran, Garrison, Minnesota. Emmanuel Lutheran, Kansas City, Missouri. And Holy Cross Lutheran, St. Genevieve, Missouri. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, and click support. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The Church's Music from the 20th Century. The 17th Century. The 11th Century. The 8th century. The 4th century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're getting our update on the November elections with Mark and Molly Hemingway of the Weekly Standard and the Federalist. Mark, let's return a little bit to the elections to a state like Utah, where Clinton and Trump appear to be in a virtual tie, a very conservative state. What can we learn from that, Mark?
Well, all kinds of things. I mean, first of all, let's just look at this poll. The poll had Trump at 29%. It had Hillary Clinton at 26%. It had Gary Johnson, the Libertarian candidate, at 16%. And then it had other at 29%. The poll has a margin of error of 2.5 points, meaning that, in a statistical sense, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are effectively tied in a state that has not voted for a Republican presidential candidate in over 50 years.
Not voted for a Democratic.
Sorry, voted for a Democratic candidate in over 50 years. That is just astounding, but also just the general discontent. I mean, other has as much support as or more support than the two major party candidates. And if you consider that, you know, Gary Johnson, a significant amount of his support is probably just people reaching for the only other name that they were given in the poll that isn't currently under federal investigation for breaking the law. You know, a pretty sizable plurality in the poll is rejecting all of the choices. You know, Trump said he would redraw the map, but I don't think this is quite what people had in mind. But, you know, it's just one state, and obviously Utah is, you know, kind of an anomalous place in a lot of ways. But if you were looking for evidence that we could use a conservative alternative in the race, and he would do well and be disruptive in ways that were, you know, possibly, you know, positive and had a shot at winning, I mean, this is a data point that, you know, says that, you know, that person would have an opportunity.
Molly, you recently offered some thoughts on Hillary Clinton, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and a foreign policy speech. What did you find there?
Well, Hillary Clinton is typically very bad at public speech giving. She has not had many good speech writers. She doesn't feel comfortable with the content. Someone I talked to said that he heard it described as, the way she talks is described as a Wheel of Fortune contestant who slowly articulates each word and gets the emphasis wrong each time, you know, she was giving a sentence. This speech, she actually delivered it really well. And when as she was delivering it well, she felt a little bit more comfortable. And so it kind of flowed well. She billed it as a major foreign policy speech. It was actually the unveiling of how she's going to go against Donald Trump, which was to frame him as this unhinged guy who can't be trusted with foreign policy. And that's kind of a tricky move for her because she herself has such a bad track record on foreign policy, and that's also her main, you know, job qualification that she's trying to put forth. But everything that she did while she was Secretary of State has been not just bad, but legendarily bad, whether it's pushing to destabilize Libya, which has, you know, just been a complete disaster, the Russian reset, which has also not gone well, negligence when it comes to other diplomatic concerns like China's aggression and whatnot. So she doesn't have a good track record, but it showed some courage to actually go after Trump in light of her weakness in this regard. I thought it was a pretty good speech. It was well written, well delivered, and it showed some strength.
Molly's right. That foreign policy address really was a cut above for Hillary, who's generally not very good at these things. But I would add that I thought that her victory speech that she gave last night was just really terrible. I mean, it really strained to put her accomplishment repeatedly into this grand historic context where she was the culmination of the entire women's rights movement. Never mind that Hillary's own history is pretty dodgy in terms of, you know, the fact that she's at this place now because of her husband and the way he's treated women and her role in that, and just in general, it was like, I mean, I wanted to round up the speechwriters and take them back to their cubicles at the greeting card factory where she found them. I mean, it was just, you know, one cliche, you know, an example of overused rhetorical devices like repetition of things just again and again and again, a lot of strained metaphors. So I don't know. You know, she may have her moments from time to time, but I would not expect her to be a great retail candidate looking forward.
Molly, one other thing that you have offered your thoughts on, and it kind of broke my irony meter to notice that BuzzFeed is refusing Trump advertising based upon its conscience, I suppose. Talk about that we got about a minute here.
Yeah, the CEO, Jonah Peretti, sent a note to all employees saying that they were reneging on a contract they'd signed with the Republican National Committee to do ads in the fall on Donald Trump. I forget what the amount was, but, you know, over $1 million contract that they were breaking their side of the bargain with. And it was just an interesting thing to see. I thought it was good that, as the media praised this decision for such bravery and whatnot, that a corporation would refuse or deny a service based on conscience objections. I thought, oh, well, maybe the media will extend this right to deny service because of conscience objections, not just to BuzzFeed, but to the bakers and the florists for being sued out of existence because they fail to go along with the new sexual doctrines being perpetuated by the left. But, yeah, so BuzzFeed has the right to do it, but they're being a little bit hypocritical. And also, it's just really bad for their reporters. Yesterday, their reporters were complaining that they weren't allowed into a denied access to a Donald Trump event. And everybody was like, yeah, but your corporation is denying them access in advertising. It's just tit for tat. You don't really get to complain about it. So I think their reporters are probably going to be frozen out of covering a lot of this race.
And also, within a day, BuzzFeed CEO was holding a Democratic fundraiser for the DNC. So, it seems a little more, that they have some sort of agenda at the top.
Mark Hemingway, senior writer for the Weekly Standard. Mark, thank you very much.
Thanks again.
Molly, senior editor for The Federalist. Molly, thank to you as well.
Thank you.
You'll find links to their columns at issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll continue our series on Martin Luther and the Reformation. We talk with Dr. Ken Cherub about Luther's latter years, the last 15 years of his life, old man Luther, as he says. We'll also discuss media coverage of Ramadan prayers that were offered at Istanbul's Hagia Sophia, former Orthodox Cathedral, with Terry Mattingly. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening. Talk with you tomorrow on Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
When you need a friend, you have a friend in Jesus Christ, the Good Shepherd, and friends among his people at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, Arnold, Missouri. At Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, we offer Christ-centered word and sacrament ministry, inspirational liturgical worship services, and faithful preaching and teaching. Sunday worship services are at 9 a.m. Sunday school and Bible class are at 10:30. We also have an excellent Christian preschool. We invite you to join us. Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, 2211 Tenbrook Road, Arnold, Missouri, 636-296-1292.
What would you say if someone asked you to explain the Trinity? Would you begin with Scripture, the creeds, or some clever analogy? And how are Christ and the gospel at the center of this fundamental Christian teaching? Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Carl Beckwith has written a new book in the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatic series. It's titled The Holy Trinity. You can save $5 by pre-ordering The Holy Trinity at logia.org, L-O-G-I-A.org.